Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale, I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Robert P. Kolker and Nathan Abrams, the authors of a new biography on Stanley Kubrick. It looks like the definitive biography, Kubrick, An Odyssey. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, send the review, and subscribe. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, D-R-J-O-N-T-Y. And remember, there's also a sister podcast, Cinema Natalia, which I present, and which is an English language journey into Italian cinema. So be sure and check that out wherever good podcasts can be found. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. Very first book I seriously read as a young teenager, I must have been about 13, about cinema was Cinema of Loneliness. It was an absolute inspiration to me. So I wanted to express my gratitude for that. And also in that book, you are already devoting a chapter to Kubrick. Kubrick's one of your main directors and the way you're going. So what's your relationship with Kubrick? And when did you first start watching his cinema? When did you first develop this interest?
Well, I think my first Kubrick film that I saw was Paths of Glory at MoMA. And this would have been in the early 60s, probably mid-60s. It struck me immediately as something extraordinary. When I did Cinema of Loneliness, I was clear about how Kubrick fit in what was then the overall theme of the book. That theme sort of got submerged in subsequent editions as more directors were added and others were dropped. But the Kubrick chapter kept getting longer in subsequent editions. It was clear that there was more than a simple film fan's attraction to Kubrick. There was something oddly personal, even though I obviously never met the man. Powerful enough that I wanted to go further, deeper, And the idea for doing a biography started in the early 1990s and, in fact, corresponded with Leon Vitali, faxed a few times, and until I got a letter from Julian Sr., one of his Warner Brothers protectors, who incidentally just died recently, shutting the door, basically telling me to go away and stop bothering them. So I went away and stopped bothering them. And then when I met Nathan and we talked and thought and talked and thought some more, we eventually decided to do a book on Eyes Wide Shut, and that turned out very well. We decided to take it one step further and do the life.
I'm a bit curious as to why the door was shut. Was it just like, I don't want to bother, I don't want, it's too intrusive, or was there any reason given?
Because I was bold enough to ask for access to the archives. This was before the archives were public, and that was really the last straw for them.
Really, a similar question for Nathan. What was your first experience with Kubrick?
Before I answer that, I'm going to say, Bob, imagine if you had been given access back then. You'd have had to do all that archival research on your own, because in the early 80s, what, I was like eight, which is you imagine all that digging back then with no sense of cataloguing the archive as it was. Yeah, my first experience of watching a Kubrick film in the cinema was Full Metal Jacket in 1987.
Ah, same here.
So that maybe puts us at a similar age. So I was 15. I'm not sure I went to see it as a Kubrick film, but more as a war film. Subsequently, I did deliberately go to see Eyes Wide Shut as a Kubrick film. So that's the one I really anticipated. I was more adult then and went to see that the day it came out in the UK. And it occurs to me that the other film that I saw in the cinema closest to the point that you could in the UK was A Clockwork Orange, which I owned on a VHS bought in Amsterdam, because obviously it wasn't available in the UK, but I did go to see that. I think 2000 was when it was released finally, or again in the UK. So my prehistory with Kubrick is much shorter. But really, my interest was much more generated. I mean, I'd always admired him when I moved here to Bangor University and was asked to teach a new module. So I put Kubrick because he's perfect for an 11-week semester. Back then, there were only 12 films. Now there's 13 because we have a decent copy of Fear and Desire. And he covers every genre. And the one genre he didn't do, fortunately, is Westerns. So it was perfect for my purposes, and it was really that led me to Bob, and here we are.
And how did that collaboration, well, you've already said you worked on a Eyes Wide Shut book together, but how did that collaboration begin?
Nathan and others had to convince me about the film, because on first look, I was really put off by the film. I thought it was a disaster, quite frankly. And it took me many viewings and many conversations with Nathan and with other friends to get to the film's soul. And once I got there, it, like all of Kubrick's films, didn't leave and kept gnawing. So Nathan introduced me to the archives. I did a little scrounging, but I can't hold a candle to the way Nathan works in archival research. It's just something that he does miraculously well and that I don't. But we put a lot of material together. We collaborated on the writing just perfectly, I think. The biggest disappointment was that the book was published by Oxford University Press, who decided not to publicize it. It sort of disappeared. It's reappeared because our current publishers, Faber and Pegasus, the publishers of the biography, have used the few review quotations that did come out about Eyes Wide Shut on the back of the book, on the back of the bio, and that, I think, has drawn more readers to it. So it's had sort of a second life.
When you approach the idea of doing a biography together, and you've already sort of mentioned this in a way, doing it as two writers, was that the division of labor then, Bob? Was Nathan doing the archival research and you were doing more the framing and the writing?
No. In terms of the archival research, I did some, but in terms of the writing, this was total collaboration.
You would be going back and forth. You would be having discussions.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Emailing, sending drafts back and forth, correcting each other, adding, subtracting. We worked well together.
There must have been at times disagreements about, I don't know, judgments of films or even disagreements about interpretations of certain moments in Kubrick's life. Was that ever a problem or were they positive and nourishing?
I can't remember any blistering disagreements. Nathan?
No, I mean, nothing blistering. I think I can give one example of where we perhaps took our time to reconcile our views, which is on the value of Spartacus to the development of Kubrick's career, which I see as absolutely essential to understanding the Kubrick that became the Kubrick after Spartacus. And one of the arguments we would have is Bob would say Spartacus lacks irony, which I accept. But not all his films before Spartacus had irony. And the ones that did have irony were because he worked on Spartacus. So I think there's an importance to value the role that played in the Stanley Kubrick becoming the Stanley Kubrick that most people know and love. And the interesting thing about doing this biography is there's different Stanley Kubricks. There's the one in The Photographer, there's the one who made Fear and Desire and Killer's Kiss, then there's the one who makes The Killing, James B. Harris, and there's the one who's married to Christiane with Paths of Glory. And then there's the mature Kubrick after Spartacus. And even then that changes. So I think people come with their idea of who Kubrick is and then export it backwards rather than read it forwards. But yeah, you know, obviously we might disagree over the salience of a particular factoid or whether we should include something or not. But yeah, it's a very smooth collaboration. I think one of the things that assisted our collaboration in part answer to the previous question that my dog really wanted to answer was I come from a history background and moved into film, and Bob started off with literature and moved into film. And I think those strengths and complementary abilities reflect in the working process, and that I have the patience to go to archives. I enjoyed all that, and Bob has an encyclopedic knowledge of film that he'll forget more than I ever know. And you know, so those complementary abilities meant, you know, we didn't have to reinvent the wheel and do everything. You know, I could draw upon what he knew, and also I live closer to the archives, so I could go do that stuff, and I could go contact the ones around the world to find additional material. So yeah, I think, and it enables us to write a book doubly quickly.
Which is always useful.
Exactly, exactly.
And there's always a feeling, as I was reading the book, there was always a feeling of a sort of the road not taken as well, that, you know, in terms of Spartacus, that was true, but also in terms of One-Eyed Jacks and in terms of other things, that was a sense of like, if he learned a lesson, it might be a positive lesson, I'm good at doing this, but it also might be a negative lesson, I'm definitely not going to do that. I mean, perhaps one of the best examples of that is Fear and Desire, where the lessons he took away from that were a very mixed bag indeed, and he sort of came to regret them. What's your own sort of take on that film?
Didn't he say pain is a good teacher? Because I think the reception on that film was less than he would have liked. I mean, but you know, it gave him the experience of shooting a film. I think he said the best way to learn to make a film is to go and do it. And that's exactly what he did with almost zero training. And he made plenty of mistakes. Although the interesting thing is he repeated them again in some senses on Killer's Kiss in terms of technical processes. But narrative-wise, he did learn to be a bit more subtle, because in Fear and Desire, as we say in the book, I think he showed his hand too much. You know, the chess master revealed his strategy in advance. It's not immediately obvious in Killer's Kiss. You know, Killer's Kiss is if you want to say a better film than Fear and Desire, but not considered one of his greatest, but maybe by The Killing and Paths of Glory, you know, he's learned to conceal his hand better.
One of the periods in Kubrick's life that we learned most about and were most revealing were the what he was doing in the early 1950s, which I think no one else has commented upon in as detailed as we have, as Nathan has, in discovering the letters and the stories that he wrote, and his life in the village and his marriages. He was an extraordinarily active individual for many, many years. He was bi-coastal. He went from New York to Los Angeles. Fear and Desire was filmed in the hills outside of Los Angeles. And it was also a time of disappointments. He made two features and three documentaries and was poor as a church mouse, didn't make a penny. And he was saved, literally, by James Harris, who became his producer and who had money and who relieved Kubrick of the constant searching for material, took a lot of the burden and allowed Kubrick to be Kubrick or to become Kubrick, which he does in The Killing and in Paths of Glory. Fear and Desire and Killer's Kiss are fascinating films, but they are films of a tyro working things out, trying to figure out where he is as a filmmaker. Whereas in The Killing, and especially in Paths of Glory, the discovery is made.
There are flashes of brilliance in both those films, but yeah, they're not sustained. Yeah, absolutely. And Paths of Glory, I think, is probably one of my favorite films, not just of Kubrick's, but perhaps of all time. I love the stories as well of him, you know, earning money by doing high stakes poker games and chess.
There is a chess player in The Killing, and he recreates, Kubrick recreates his chess parlor where he played in New York.
Yeah, but there's also sort of a daring in the young man of, like, especially sitting down and playing poker for lots of money when you don't have much money as a way of financing your household.
John's talking about chutzpah. Chutzpah, I think we use the word in the book, does define a young Kubrick, probably an older one too, but there is, you know, there is a self-belief at times combined with a boldness that I'm going to do this and I'm going to get this done. You know, him sitting there thinking in the cinema before he's made a film, I can make films better than this, and doing it. There's the chutzpah and sending the photograph to Look magazine in 1945, and then persevering. I mean, one of the things that hopefully becomes clear in the book is that he didn't always get his finance guaranteed. You know, even once he signed with Warner Brothers, he's not going to get every project greenlit. So up to that point, he has to have tremendous self-belief to keep going, trying to get the financing for each project. You know, Spartacus was handed to him. One-Eyed Jacks was handed to him, but as he suspected, that was probably never for him to direct. But the films before that, he had to beg, borrow, and steal, and he had to do the same with Lolita and with Dr. Strangelove and with 2001. So it isn't just this kind of, it looks like a trajectory where each film is better than the last and Kubrick's on the up and nothing can stop him. But I don't think he would have seen the reality that way. So it keeps tremendous self-belief to keep him going, you know, every time he's getting knocked down. Because, you know, he's at the height of his powers with 2001, and he's emerged from Dr. Strangelove with his critical esteem. He can make a movie with money that makes money. And then, you know, look at the initial critical reception of 2001, which really, you know, he never goes to a movie premiere again after that, because it really deals him a blow. So just at the point where you think he's at the height of his powers, nothing can stop him, he'll get a whack. And I think that takes self-belief to keep going, you know, and to not just give up, or not just go with an easy product that, you know, let's look at what the cycle is. Let's just do exactly a cookie cutter movie of that cycle, which kind of largely guaranteed some sort of return. So yeah, I think that definitely defines him through his career.
That's what's interesting about the relationship that he has with Steven Spielberg, which emerges very well in your book. I think I haven't seen that relationship delineated in such detail before and with such precision. That ambiguity that Kubrick is constantly going, God damn it, I wish I could make a film like you and make all this money. But you know, and he probably knows that he's never gonna do that. He's never gonna compromise or hit that zeitgeist moment quite in the same way.
There are, it's interesting, there's sort of two operative dichotomies in Kubrick's life. One in the films, which is the tension between reality and what he called the interesting. Reality is good, he said, interesting is better. And in his working life, there's the dichotomy between what you said, the knowledge that he makes films that he well knows are not going to be enormously popular at first outing, and the desire to do that. And the relationship with Spielberg, I think, is a combination of those dichotomies. There's no indication that the friendship was anything but mutual and sincere. But I think part of the relationship was that Kubrick wanted to buddy up with someone who made films that were enormously popular at first go, as opposed to making films that only became enormously popular years after they appeared.
And even extending a professional relationship in terms of becoming a producer of AI and sort of handing it off to Spielberg, which ultimately occurred posthumously.
I think he recognizes as well that Spielberg can make films in not in less than half the time. You know, Kubrick's dithering over Aryan Papers in 93. Meanwhile, Spielberg has shot and is editing Jurassic Park whilst shooting Schindler's List. And there was a recognition, and that's in part why he handed him AI, that he could shoot this quicker. And one of the things he joked was that the reason why he couldn't use a real child actor in AI is because by the time he'd done with him, he'd have a beard and an Adam's apple. And so I think there was that recognition that he was a slow worker, but he couldn't do anything about that.
Yeah, I mean, even in The Shining, Danny Lloyd seems noticeably older at certain scenes than others. You know, he's aging as the shoot progresses.
You know, on that note, I didn't realize this until a visit to the archives more recently. They had two pairs of shoes for him. I think, you know, the ones he wore and the ones he might have grown into. So they did plan ahead for The Shining in recognition of just he wasn't a quick worker.
I mean, these things are quite consistent as well when it comes to, you know, again, going through the earlier period. There's always this sort of attempt to hunt up a story, attempt to find a book or a literary work like Lolita that he can work with. There's always this slightly torrid relationship with writers. Jim Thompson is an early example of that as well. And that sort of continues all the way to the end, and Frederick Raphael and Brian Aldiss and others. It would have been so much simpler if he'd sort of just had that original screenplay in himself.
Well, if you're asking, could he do an original screenplay himself? Is that the question?
I guess so, yeah.
He was clear that he couldn't do that. He was clear that he needed a literary reference or literary foundation on which to build a film. That was true for everything except the two earliest films, Fear and Desire and Killer's Kiss.
Do you think it was the experience of doing those films that made him think, right, I need to have something to, these don't work as stories, these don't work as characters?
I expect so, because he kept writing ideas for stories. A lot of them, frankly, silly ideas. At the same time, ideas about marriage and jealousy and sexuality that would become Eyes Wide Shut many, many years later. He discovers Schnitzler, and he discovers Stefan Zweig, and he sees in those writers themes developed that he was only tinkering with. Mm. And so he wants to make a film of a Stefan Zweig story, The Burning Secret, and gets almost to the production stage before it's dropped. And Schnitzler is with him throughout his life until at the end of his life he finally gets to do the film.
I wanted to come in there to reflect that it's every stage of Kubrick's process. Had he been able to generate an original screenplay or work from one, had he been able to not research as intensively, had he not been able to exhaust every possibility before actually editing, then yeah, everything would have gone quicker. So it isn't just the screenplay that's at issue. Every stage of the process is laborious. I think the quickest he took to make a film in his mature years was, what, 2 years? From announcement to release. So everything is laborious. I think in part because he didn't have James B. Harris to help him out, and in part because of his character. One thing, it just recurs to me, that we did argue over argue. We disagreed over is the extent to which Kubrick was a writer. Bob gave him more credit than I did. I said he's a good adapter at best. Like, so he did adapt.
A rewriter rather than a writer in that sense. So he would sort of put things together and rephrase things, but not actually generate that stuff.
Yeah, he couldn't generate an original script. I mean, by his own admission, he's a terrible writer. And if you look through some of the early stuff, it's, you know, he could add ideas to a film. And the early stuff, some of it has a plot, there's characterization, there's this script. The scraps here or there, you know. He did Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon, Napoleon, and Aryan Papers on his own. He did the screenplay. I don't know if we can call what was Napoleon a screenplay as such. It probably would have had further work on it. And by his own words, that was because, at least in the case of the of Clockwork Orange and Barry Lyndon, they were easy to adapt. They were very screenplay-like anyway. And so he didn't have that in him as much as he would have liked to. So he always then needed to work with other people, and preferably writers who weren't the writers of the source material.
It's interesting because I'm kind of thinking how, wishing that Kubrick would hurry up, so to speak, or not do is kind of a bit like wishing Jackson Pollock was a little bit neater. I mean, it's part and parcel of their art of what they, if he did speed up, then you wouldn't necessarily get Barry Lyndon. You wouldn't necessarily get 2001: A Space Odyssey. The process is in well, I mean, let me phrase that as a question. Is the process intrinsic to the work, or is it something which perhaps later on in his career starts to hamper the work?
We simply wouldn't have the films we have if he had done them any other way. I mean, it's a sort of circular argument. He worked slowly, and the result of that slow work was the careful, meticulous, thoughtful, resonant films that resulted. If they were one-offs, I mean, how many times do we go back to Spielberg's version of AI as opposed to going back to The Shining or Full Metal Jacket or Eyes Wide Shut or any Kubrick film? There's a difference. Spielberg's facility results in often enough facile films, not every time, but much of the time. Kubrick's different kind of facility is the result of very careful planning, very thoughtful, and full of doubt, I think, in the process, in the best sense, in the process of coming up with a film. Doubt in the sense that he's always questioning what's here, how is it going to be filmed, what is cinematic about what I'm reading and what I'm writing. How are the actors going to do it? How can I get the most perfect shot? And so forth. And the result of that is the answer is yes, you did all of that. Everything worked out.
I've just been working on a book about Terrence Malick, a biography as well, and I was looking at the chapter on Days of Heaven, and there's a big argument about, it took 2 years to do the post-production. My argument after everything is just like, yeah, but it's one of the best films from the 1970s, which is an era not exactly poor with very good films. So if it took him 2 years, good on him. The end product is proof of argument, really. Another aspect of Kubrick's life, and this is what makes the idea of a new biography so fascinating and interesting, I think your book so rewarding, is that there is such a sort of legend around Kubrick as well. There's so many stories, there's so many ideas, all of which you sort of take into account and take into and at times challenge and defeat. And yet at the same time, there are certain seeds of truth to these legends. One of the most famous ones is his fear of flying. And I was really interested in learning in your biography how early on that actually, and how early on and how categorical that was, and how kind of almost like medical it was, really. It wasn't just, a neurosis as such. It was kind of manifested itself physically as well.
It's a very rational choice. I mean, he flew planes. He monitored air traffic control. It's like with a lot of facts about Kubrick, depending on what position you want to take, you can interpret the fact that he didn't like flying as a phobia or as a rational fear based on sound analysis and experience of flying. And I think we found a lot of situations like that where you could take a fact and read Kubrick as a monster, and we weren't trying to give that impression. We were just trying to show there's different sides to the individual. What surprised me actually in the last few weeks is just how little a lot of people know about Kubrick. Maybe we just surround ourselves with the aficionados, and the consequence is that we forget that a lot of people only know those few things. You know, they might not, you know, that he wasn't American, or that he wasn't Jewish, or that he was Jewish, you know, that he wasn't British. It's so that there's a lot of interesting things swirling around out there. And that was one of the hopes of the book, was to puncture some of the mythology, but also to bring to a wider readership a lot of the work that had been done, but had been confined to the specialists.
And in the end, that sort of legend kind of damages his reputation to some degree as well. If he just becomes a silly sort of collection of silly quirks, and he did 120 takes of a certain scene, and the story about Shelley Duvall, which you also, I think, has been effectively countered in other places as well as your biography.
Well, the myth of the multiple takes is ultimately boring in the sense that there are other directors. I mean, William Wyler was infamous for doing a lot of takes, and it didn't become a big thing. I mean, for him, it became a kind of joke. For Kubrick, it became a kind of mark of one of his obsessions. He did a lot of takes because he needed to see the kind of performance that would fit into what he perceived as the whole of the film. He did a lot of takes because if an actor didn't know his or her lines, he kept doing it over and over until they did. He didn't much care for actors in the sense that he had to deal with personalities that would perhaps bump against what he wanted and what he needed. And so one of the things he did with the multiple takes was wear them down until they got to the core of what he needed for the film. He was not brutal. He wasn't a sadist. He just made the actors work.
Looking at those performances as well, again, you know, using the Days of Heaven analogy, he brought out extremely memorable performances. You know, you look at his films and you think of Malcolm McDowell in Clockwork Orange. You think of Ryan O'Neill, Matthew Modine, Peter Sellers, of course, and George C. Scott in Dr. Strangelove. You know, some of these are sort of career best performances in filmographies that are quite large.
I think the issue with Kubrick is it depends what position you want to take. Some people say the ends didn't justify the means. And others say, yeah, the ends did justify the means. It's interesting about Kubrick is that for those who know him, he's a divisive figure. So some would say he was brutal and sadistic. And there are instances where perhaps his treatment of actors was less than perfect. I mean, you know, we did mention instances from 2001 with the stuntman doing the oxygen scenes, and the amount of pain and torture that Malcolm McDowell went through on A Clockwork Orange, and there's other examples. So, you know, obviously we've written a book about Kubrick, and we like his films, but it's a hard one to say actually scraping Malcolm McDowell's eyelids justified the performance he got out of it. that's a tricky one, but you're right, it is a very memorable performance. I think what we've discovered, there is a bit of Marmite to Kubrick and his reputation, films aside.
And you make the point as well that there are occasions where an actor turns up and just does something sort of in three takes and gets it straight away, like Vincent D'Onofrio in Full Metal Jacket, and he's like, yep, that's it, we've got it, you know, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, and there could be, and he gives them that sort of fist on the shoulder. There could be loads of reasons why.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A takes that isn't just so the actor hasn't done their lines or it doesn't look right. There could be a technical fault or a boom mic visible. Or I doubt there's very many directors that do 1 or 2, 3 takes and get what they want exactly, unless their bar's so low that they don't care. And yeah, and there's many instances where the actor gives them something that he didn't even know he was looking for until the actor did it. Mm. And so there's the instances where there's a lot of improvisation, which he learned from Spartacus, but right from Lolita onwards, those moments of inspiration and improvisation that weren't there in the screenplay draft, such as they were, that in a sense that people remember those moments from the film, you know, Here's Johnny or Singing in the Rain, amongst other examples.
Peter Sellers in Lolita, yeah, just getting the opportunity to go and riff and do stuff and create a character that doesn't really exist.
Yeah, and the best moment, a moment I really like, every time I watch Doctor Strangelove, I always tell audiences to look out for this when he's playing Doctor Strangelove and he's in the wheelchair and he's strangling himself and then biting his fist to stop the fist from strangling himself. And if you look at Peter Ball's face, who's playing the Desarsky, the Russian ambassador, you can completely tell that they didn't know this was going to happen. And the look on Peter, I don't look at Peter Sellers anymore. I look at Peter like a schoolboy, a naughty schoolboy, desperately trying not to laugh on camera, which once seen, you can't unsee. And it's moments like that. George C. Scott, I mean, this is my favorite Kubrick film, George C. Scott tripping up in the war room. And he was meant to be called Schmuck, General Buck Schmuck. And even though he doesn't retain that name, he very much plays like one. And that tripping up, which Kubrick left in, just plays to that image. So there's something about the working environment that he creates, that these moments come out and he keeps them. So because he's not, as much as he could be authoritarian, he wasn't dictatorial.
Was there a film, I mean, you just mentioned that Strangelove is your favourite, but was there a film that you changed your view of as you went through the biography, that is putting everything in context and look and doing the research and looking at the background, and how is there a film that you either had more appreciation of or changed your critical view of as a result of the years spent working on the biography?
Yeah, I think for me, The Killing,
mm.
sort of a film that I've always liked, but my estimation of it has grown.
How so?
Because I'm really fascinated by the films of the 50s, wrote a book about them, and The Killing is so much a part of what was being made in terms of low-budget films, and at the same time bears the stamp of something different. It's like and unlike a 50s gangster film, a 50s heist film. It's interesting because all of the faces and all the actors in The Killing are familiar. They are, for the most part, actors who've appeared in dozens of films of the period and earlier. They're familiar faces, and yet they're doing unfamiliar things. I find the time scheme and the mix-up, the breaking of linear narrative fascinating, which the studio obviously hated, and which at one time in the process, Kubrick and Harris tried to straighten it out to make a linear film, a linear narrative, and they found it just didn't work. So they added a narrator, and the narrator for a long time for me seemed to be an intrusion. But as Nathan has pointed out, the narrator is often wrong and misleading. So this is the misdirection that Nathan talks about so often in terms of Kubrick's films. The Killing is also, it's a film of the cultural moment. It's a film that shows that Kubrick was absorbing the early moments of existentialism that were seeping into American culture, and something that would remain with him. So Kubrick is very much a child of the 50s. His his devotion to existentialism, to Freudianism, to Viennese literature stays with him throughout his career. And The Killing is just a kind of thumbprint that marks the beginning of all of this.
Yeah, the thing about the voiceover, I'll have to rewatch it because it's something I'd never cottoned onto, the unreliable narrator. Nathan?
Yeah, he left that in deliberately to annoy the studio, who insisted on having one in the first place. You know, and that's the story, one of the stories. But I think, like Bob said, it plays into that kind of Kubrickian sense of humor. Well, you know what? Let's have a narrator that, if you actually follow closely, it won't add up. But he also knew that people wouldn't. I mean, how many times have I watched that film and I wouldn't have picked up on the timeline unless I'd read it somewhere? For me, I mean, it's the films of the 50s that have grown on me in particular. I think Fear and Desire isn't as bad as people have made it out to be. There's a lot in that movie, a lot of techniques and other, you know, I teach bits of it for Soviet Montage, amongst other things. I think the use of doubles is very clever, and how they're playing themselves and fits into the kind of some of the themes Bob's just talked about. You watch the boxing sequences in Fear and Desire, and you can see why that influenced Scorsese.
In Killer's Kiss, you mean?
Yeah, sorry, Killer's Kiss. Yeah, apologies. And you can see why that influenced Scorsese for Raging Bull. I mean, some of those shots are brilliant. How he captures a fight in process, and you forget, actually, you're watching a stage fight. There's one point where I think he hits the camera, or at least it looks like he's hitting the it's a sort of piece to camera with a punch to camera. You know, obviously there's The Killing, and I watched that again with the students, and you just pick up on little things. And one of the little ironies, to use Bob's phrase, that I noticed this time round was as Johnny Clay's at the check-in desk trying to get all that money in the bag, and what's framed are the words from American Airlines is the rica, which means rich in Spanish. And it's a lovely frame because that's what Johnny thinks he is. And that's about the opposite of what he's about to become. And there's these little, you know, is it intentional? Is it otherwise? It doesn't matter because the film sustained this level of reading. And then Paths of Glory. I mean, there's so many moments in that. And the moment for me that I love in Paths of Glory is that the sparks, the action is when the two generals are having a conversation about taking the anthill. And you've got this lovely kind of deep focus and swirling camera work. And it's when the sort of inferior general, the lower ranked general, refuses the offer of a drink, and then when his superior refuses a drink, that the lower ranked general realizes he's messed up and needs to take this anthill. And it's such a tiny moment. He goes I don't think I'll have that drink. And then he twigs, I need to get promoted to please this general, I need to take the anthill. It's a moment that you'll miss it. It's at a very Kubrickian moment that I think is consistent with his work, that food and drink often motivates the action or is important in the action. It's you know, and everyone talks about the tracking shots that have been influential on Saving Private Ryan. And there are there's not to dispute any of that. But sometimes there's those little moments that just capture something, actually, you know, like the rica, like the boxing in Killer's Kiss, like the refusal of the drink in Paths of Glory, that sometimes get overlooked by the bigger gestures.
Also, the introduction to sociology on the bookshelf in the prostitute's flat in Eyes Wide Shut is always one of those jokes that I find, just brilliantly done. And you just know... You know it's there. You know it's. I mean, and this to talk a little bit about the rewatchability of Kubrick's films. One of the films which gets most rewatched and most theorized, and you talk about this quite a lot as well, is The Shining. You know, The Shining has so many, and it's a film that's so maddening in so many ways because it kind of doesn't work and it kind of absolutely does. It's almost, it sort of seems to me to supersede its genre, that it's, you know, we talk about elevated horror these days, which I think is a little bit of a sniffy term, but The Shining is one of those films that perhaps justifies it more than any other. What was your attitude to The Shining going in?
Well, I have many attitudes depending on when I saw it. And the last time I saw it was fairly recently, and it is a film of dread. It's a film of imposing danger, cosmic danger. I'm taken by the fact that, and this is a whole other conversation about Kubrick's use of music, but the use of the Dies Irae, the Day of Wrath, theme that occurs at the beginning of Clockwork Orange and also at the beginning of The Shining. The sense of ultimate doom that I think hung over Kubrick. I don't know if it hung over Kubrick, hung over Kubrick's work. The sense that things will end and end badly. And The Shining, there's so much nonsense about The Shining. And maybe that's because what The Shining is ultimately about is really scary, scarier than a ordinary horror film. It's about the ultimate end of things.
For me, what really changed with The Shining, and take this how you want, I've said it quite a few times, is once I became a father, I think I understood that film better. I mean, there is definitely, it's a film about white male privilege and entitlement and the sense of injustice when that entitlement and privilege is restricted. And it's the moment where he's making his point with a baseball bat and talking about responsibilities. And I think he uses the word seven times. And I'm not going to say there's empathy there, but I began to understand that film much more with that shift in my life. I think that's what's interesting about these films, that as you change, your readings of the films change. And when you teach these films, the new students coming in, different generation, different influences, maybe they know Kubrick, maybe they don't, their views of it change, and their views change your views because they see things you haven't seen, just as maybe we've seen things they haven't seen. And I think that's what's fascinating about this process. And again, I mean, even we talked about Eyes Wide Shut earlier. Well, I just learned recently, so here's to pick up on your example there, John, is that the version of Introducing Sociology was a British edition. So even stranger, probably an error, because the sex worker was to be an NYU student in sociology. But someone's written a whole article on this fact, an academic article, no less. Not, you know, Bob might see it as a cranky theory, but it's not one of the Room 237 cranky theories. It's an academic theory on the fact that it's the British version of Introducing Sociology that we see in Eyes Wide Shut. And I think few filmmakers sustain this level of reading. And the one other film I want to add that in terms of really changing seeing on the big screen is Barry Lyndon. I challenge my students. I say, you go watch Barry Lyndon on a big screen and you come out and tell me if you still think Kubrick's a cold filmmaker. Because if I think anyone who thinks Kubrick's a cold filmmaker after watching Barry Lyndon, then they don't have any emotions themselves. And interestingly enough, at the end of my course, I asked the students to rank the films. And Barry Lyndon, I mean, by no means unanimously, featured high or top on a lot of them. I liked it as a testament to my browbeating, but I think... I think they came to that conclusion themselves. That, you know, when you see Barry crying on that big screen, how can you not be moved?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and the words of the narrator, which are often so frequently framed as a sort of alienating device, are actually, you know, you can say what you like about Barry Lyndon, but he loved his son, you know, incredibly moving. Speaking of family, we were talking earlier about how, Bob, you were sort of frustrated in the early 80s about writing the biography by the lack of access or being denied access. How was it in terms of going back and doing it? Did you have opportunities to interview the family? How do they feel about the biography? How did it go this time around?
We interviewed his daughter, Katerina, mm-hmm. And we had many conversations through email and in person with Jan Harlan, his brother-in-law. And Jan was very helpful in correcting mistakes. He was sometimes a little pushy in wanting us to say things that we had either not thought of or didn't think were as important as he did. So we tried to compromise with him. The estate was helpful in getting photographs that appear in the book. So, yes, we had a lot of interchange. Both of us on separate occasions have visited Childersbury and seen the interiors and the enormous kitchen. We've seen the grave site, and all very moving.
So you got more of a sense of the man as you sort of got to know him, right?
Yeah. I mean, just to as a caveat to what Bob said, I mean, whilst we had assistance from the family, this isn't an official biography, and you know, we weren't constrained in what we said just because we worked with members of the family and others who were part of the kind of Kubrick circle. And I think it's really talking to that range of individuals, whether it's from the family members through to the creatives who worked with him maybe once, through to those who worked with him twice or had a consistent working pattern, like Julian Senior, the late Julian Senior, Bob's mentioned, or Tony Freud. You get a sense of the human beneath some of the mythology. That this there was a film director, and as a film director and a boss, he could be one person. And then there's the Kubrick at home with his family, you know, with his wife, with his daughters. He was a brother, you know, he was a son. And then how he was with his friends or with the people he worked with when they weren't on the set. You know, he said he was a different human being. And I think what I hope our book has achieved is to give a sense of the different Kubricks, depending on the context. Not quite Quilty, although, you know, I did write an academic article years ago comparing Kubrick to Quilty. And that Quilty's Kubrick's double. But, you know, not just this monolithic monster that had no consideration for the feelings of others. I think people, and it goes back to something I said to you earlier, is that people are selective about the evidence they choose to support the theory that they wish to have about Kubrick. And as much as we might come from a more positive point of view, we did try to paint the warts and all picture, give two sides. So, sorry, the story of Dorian Harewood is instructive. You know, Dorian Harewood wanted to leave early and he felt Kubrick punished him by killing him off, his character, early in the film. And then
in Full Metal Jacket, this is.
Yeah, Full Metal Jacket. Yeah, he played it's April. And he says that Kubrick made him do this grueling shot running with a machine gun through all the bullets, you know, multiple times and to punish him. And then we spoke to Jan Harlan, and Jan Harlan said, well, it's absurd Kubrick would make him do that multiple times. You know how expensive it is to put all those squibs in the wall and do the setup? And then you think about it and you're like, yeah, even if he had a vindictive streak, that would have been undermined by the cost. And so we gave the story. We said, this is how Dorian Harewood sees it. And yet, probably the truth of the matter is he did kill the character off early so he could be released from his contract. But probably not quite in the fashion that he recalls it, because, you know, the Kubrick of legendary multiple takes is a convenient brush to paint the picture with there. But the Kubrick we knew was the one who loved insurance claims and was always trying to save a bit of money here and there. So I don't think he would have. That would have been a 3-day setup, probably.
I loved the insurance claims. I loved that. That was something I'd never heard before, and it was hilarious.
We learned that through multiple interviews with one of the Warner Brothers lawyers who worked closely with Kubrick, and just filled in the most wonderful details of the working and the personal life and the absolutely legitimate use of insurance claims to buy time and get things in order was a wonderful revelation.
Well, were there any other revelations? I mean, there's so many in the book that it's a little bit putting you on the spot to ask, but were there any other revelations that you just thought, that's a beauty. That's something I love. That's going straight in the book.
That's a tough one to answer because I'd rather hear what you thought. the one little discovery I this is the one I pick on, and it's a tiny little thing, again, like that moment in Paths of Glory. There was a little note in the archive. There's new material was deposited from the 40s, you know, the 40s and the 50s. These are the period that probably there's the least written about Kubrick. It's the darkest period in a way, not psychologically, just in terms of what we know. And in amongst the stuff that Kubrick had kept was this little note of the internal mechanism of the camera he was using on Fear and Desire, and I mean Fear and Desire this time, and how the tape the film threads through the spools. And he'd written underneath in capital letters, oil every 1,000 feet, ask about that, you know, to the camera guy who was loaning him the equipment. And you just think, well, you know, the director that used push processing on Eyes Wide Shut or front projection on 2001, that innovated so many techniques, he might not have created the Steadicam, but he pushed its use in The Shining. That's where everything begins, is this tiny little note asking about oiling a camera every 1,000 feet. And that was kind of the acorn of, it's tempting to say the rosebud, but the, the, you know, the Kubrick that people understand came from that. There wasn't always that Kubrick that we know now. He had to learn along the way. So
I think the revelation for me was, interestingly enough, no revelation. That what I learned was the Kubrick that I had somehow always known but never articulated as well as we did in the book. This was the man in full, and all those little parts, the oiling of the camera, the infinite number of photographs that he took for Look magazine, stories, the desperate stories that he jotted during his unhappy Greenwich Village days. They were all of a piece of what was ultimately an artist who was relatively at peace in the last period of his life, settled in the British countryside, making the films that he wanted to make, not making the films that he didn't or couldn't make, surrounded family by family and who knows how many cats and many, many dogs, and at play and in contention with his daughters, living with a wife that must have been the most understanding person in the world, and who managed by living her own life as a painter. All of these just fit in and felt, for me, very comfortable. Non-revelatory, but positing an image, a complex image, that was in the end very satisfying.
It's like a sort of affirmation of your admiration. That it's not, yes, like, oh, there's no clay feet here, or there's nothing that I'm going to sort of go, oh, I wish I didn't know that. Finally, I was wondering about you talk about the legacy of Kubrick in the latter part of the book, and it's fascinating to look at things that have gone on. Ridley Scott's just made a Napoleon, which you know, has to be seen to some degree in the context of Kubrick's unmade Napoleon. There's a TV series posited about Napoleon, produced by Steven Spielberg. Of these sort of unproduced projects, are there any of them that you think of as kind of a loss, or do you think, no, if he had done that, we wouldn't have had Clockwork Orange, or if he'd done Napoleon, we wouldn't have had Barry Lyndon? And are there any sort of any of those projects that you really think, oh, the world would have been a richer place if that existed, or are you at peace with it as you describe Kubrick being?
Well, I mean, you can't make up what's not there, obviously. But, you know, if we had AI or Aryan Papers, there would be no Eyes Wide Shut.
There might have been an Eyes Wide Shut. I would have been intrigued to see what Kubrick's Holocaust film. I think it's just come out and it's the zone of interest. Had he had the opportunity, obviously that book wasn't written when he was alive. But the Path Not Taken film would be Burning Secrets, because that was with MGM. As a kind of studio product. They were under contract to the studio, working in the studio. It wasn't like they had the project and the studio was financing the project. It came out of their contract to work for MGM. And, you know, there's some counterfactual supposition that their careers, because it was James B. Harris as well, might have gone in a different direction. Whether Kubrick would have lasted at MGM, I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, probably would have got himself fired anyway, in the way that he did with Marlon Brando a few years later. But not on Spartacus, funny enough. Managed to hem it in there. You know, his career would have gone in a completely different direction. And just as, you know, there's this tendency, and there's at least one book that does this. It goes from Paths of Glory to Lolita. Had Kubrick not done Spartacus, yeah, he might have stayed in LA, but he wouldn't have been the one we understand him to be. Mm. And we might not have had those later films. I think there's a wish on the part of some critics and scholars as if they could overlook Spartacus and that the trajectory would have continued anyway. I mean, true, he was working on Lolita before he got called to Spartacus, but I think the stylistic director and the director working with actors would have changed, might not have moved to England. So I think there's these critical junctures that there could be a counter. I mean, it'd be good novel material. What if Kubrick had stayed at MGM? What if Kubrick hadn't done Spartacus? I think those are more crucial than what if he had made Aryan Papers. I'd just be intrigued to see what he would have done with that material, how he would have handled some of the problems of the deep problems of putting the Holocaust on film, but also his own issues with his own background and how that would have come up for Aryan Papers. Had he been healthy, I still think he would have done Eyes Wide Shut, because that was the one, that was the one he was always working on, right, for 50 years, as we argued in our book. And that's ultimately why it was his last film, probably. The culmination of his filmmaking career.
And it's interesting, I mean, continuing with legacy, it's interesting you say zone of interest, because there are a series of directors who, get the adjective. Christopher Nolan's one, Paul Thomas Anderson sometimes get, it seems to be a shorthand for anybody. Yorgos Lanthimos, I just saw somebody was doing a season of his films in Amsterdam, and the trailer had the Full Metal Jacket font all the way through for his films. I mean, there is an undeniable sort of continuing, in a way that, say, someone like, say, Francis Ford Coppola, who's still alive and still working and everything, hasn't necessarily had that. It's not like you'd look at a young filmmaker and say, oh, this is a very Francis Ford Coppola film, or this is a very William Friedkin film, Kubrick seems to have a really lasting imprimatur, if that's a word that I haven't just made up.
The example I always pick there, I mean, for me, the closest, Jonathan Glazer is one of them, because he how does he put it? I don't so much steal from him as pick his pocket, Glazer said. But there's lots of other similarities. The other one's Darren Aronofsky. For me, the two closest. But yeah, I think the issue is how many bad Kubrick films are there, right? But I bet we could sit here and have a big long list of bad Coppola, bad Scorsese, bad Nolan, bad Ridley Scott films, despite the groundbreaking ones in between. And that dampens the overall reputation, doesn't it? Yeah, Kubrick, there's always that sense. And I think you hinted at it earlier, and had he been less irritating in his working process, we might have had more films. But if we'd had more films, they possibly wouldn't have been as good.
Yeah, they would have been Jack with Robin Williams.
Yeah, I don't want to throw me there. But, there's It dampens the reputation, doesn't it? Woody Allen, or for different reasons, but there's been so many of less than stellar quality that it's taken away from the overall reputation. And I think Kubrick did so few that it's hard to use that against him.
And even the films that becomes a constant thing as you go through the book, is how this film is received in a certain way, and it's not received particularly well. And, even 2001: A Space Odyssey, you made the point earlier. And then usually the French love it, and finally we all love it. There's no resisting that staying power. And what, as Bob was saying earlier, that, it's built into the films. It's about that meticulousness that makes you want to go back and revisit them 1,000 times, despite that number of films that he's made. I've probably watched him more than any other filmmaker. A final question for both of you. This is something I ask all my guests on Writers on Film, which is a film book recommendation for listeners, something to send them off in any direction. Any direction you like, really. I know it's a toughie, but I also don't necessarily limit it to just one. Bob, you like to go first?
I'm at a loss. I must say, I've not been reading a lot of film books, and nothing comes to mind.
That's funny, because last time you had one and I didn't, and now this time I've got one and you don't. I can't remember who you said last time we were asked this question. I'll fill in about, for me... Okay. Joseph McBride's biography of Steven Spielberg, the new edition. It's really well researched, really thorough, loads of references. Just to give you one little factoid that it answers another question, maybe give Bob time to think, is there was one in the relationship between Spielberg and Kubrick. It was reported that Kubrick always called Spielberg collect. Reverse charges, as we say in the UK. And yeah, and Harlan was like, why would he do that? He's got his own money. Why? This is absurd. It's made up. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to dig through the sources for this one. And it was quoted in Joseph McBride's book. So I contacted Joe and said, can you find me the source for this? And he sent me all the material, and I looked through, and it was something Spielberg had said in an interview. So this is an interesting thing. I mean, this is the level of detail, that the book has, but obviously helped us with AI, with the stuff on AI in particular. And we had to reconcile this. Like, Spielberg says it probably happened, Why would he make that up? They're mates. And the Anon's like, no, no, this wouldn't have happened. So yeah, there's my recommendations. Because some of the
I have one. Glenn Frankel's making of Midnight Cowboy is a fine piece of cultural as well as cinematic criticism.
Both writers who have been on Writers on Film, and yeah, Glenn's book is amazing. I haven't read Joe's book on Steven Spielberg, so I'll have to put that on my list, because that's, I love the idea of reversing the charges as well, Colin Collette, because that they're having like 10-hour conversations as well. So that is not, even for very rich people, that is still quite a significant chunk of phone bill right there.
I liked Bob's explanation. He said, forgive me if I'm misquoting you, in which case I'll claim it as my own, but I'm sure Bob said, probably Kubrick the Nudnik was there going, you know what, the Hollywood wonder kid, he can pay for the call, he earns so much money. And I thought, yeah, that probably is what happened.
Yeah, yeah, he's picking up the bill. He'll pay.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, he's making so much money off E.T. He's making so much money off Jurassic Park. He can pay for the call. I thought that was an elegant solution to this where he did it, he didn't do it scenario. Maybe in the next edition we can put that little gloss in there, because it really does speak to that sense of humor Kubrick had.
Something that everybody talks about as well. That's one of those human things. You were asking me earlier what surprised me about about Kubrick, or what came through that I hadn't considered. It was that sense of daily humor, that sense of people talking about how much fun he was to work for as well, and not just the nightmare or the monster or the, you know, the legend, but he was just kind of fun. He was kind of and that really came through the biography.
Yeah, I mean, Jan Harlan, I remember him once telling me, you know, you would have liked him, and I think, to which I wanted to say, but Jan, would you have liked me?
Definitely, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Thank you guys so much, Nathan and Robert Kolker. Nathan Abrams and Robert Kolker, thanks for being on Writers on Film.
Thank you. Thank you.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.